Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Well, it's not every day that we get a legend up in the house, and I still can't even believe this happened. But before we get into this very special episode with Dr. Adam Back, I want to share a few quick words about a couple of fantastic Bitcoin-only companies. Swan Bitcoin is by far the easiest and most affordable way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring purchases. Just set it and forget it. Start your plan today and get $10 of free Bitcoin dropped into your account if you use my link swanbitcoin.com/matrix. But then you have to think seriously about getting your sats off of your exchange and protecting your Bitcoin from disaster and bad dogs. CipherSafe offers a full line of physical stainless steel products to help you protect your Bitcoin from various modes of failure. CipherSafe creates metal seed word storage devices that back up your Bitcoin wallet and protect them from physical disaster and single points of failure. CipherSafe also manufactures the Bitcoin recovery tag to permanently record critical information about your hardware wallet. When you've decided to be your own bank and hold your stack yourself, it's time to create a physical backup to protect those keys and your precious Satoshis. Now keep your sats safe, go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Adam Back, where he reflects on the cypherpunk movement, cryptography, hashcash, Satoshi, and the development of Bitcoin.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Dr. Adam Back is a renowned cryptographer and cypherpunk. Prior to his involvement in the Bitcoin space, Adam Back was known as an early pioneer of the digital currency movement. Adam developed Hashcash in 1997. Years later, this advancement provided the foundation for Bitcoin mining. Adam's work is referenced in Satoshi Nakamoto's original 9-page Bitcoin white paper. Adam Back was also an architect and cryptographer at Zero Knowledge Systems, working on its Freedom Network, a precursor to Tor. In 2014, Adam Back co-founded a company called Blockstream, and he has been the CEO of Blockstream since he was appointed in 2016. Adam Back, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
It's good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is quite an honor to be chatting with you. Quite frankly, when I started the podcast, I probably didn't even dream this big. So this is really exciting. And I'd really kind of just like to get into you a bit and your background, and then obviously encryption, cryptography, and distributed systems and Bitcoin, of course. From what I read, it seems like you got your exposure to computers through video games. Is that true? And how big of a role did video games play in your life?
I mean, I had an early computer, like a Z80 based computer, and I played a few games. I had to go at reverse engineering them, where you could edit the maps or figure out how to bypass limits and things like that. And then I got into programming them with they included a basic language on a ROM. And then I also later had to go at teaching myself Z80 machine code and assembly language, which is interesting.
Sure. Was this all self-taught?
Yeah, I was a teenager at the time, so I was doing this in my free time, and I found it fascinating. It's the sort of thing that people can get a bug for, an interest in the ability. The computer's individual instructions are quite simple, but at the lowest level. But it's immensely fast, even back then, the clock rate on these things is over a megahertz or something. We're talking gigahertz these days, but already a megahertz is a lot of cycles. Of course, at that point, the instructions took multiple cycles, depending on the instruction. Nowadays, you get more instructions per cycle. Computers have moved along a lot since that time. This would be, you know, mid-80s, that kind of time frame. But, you know, you could do a lot with this thing, and I suppose people who programmed them would get pretty close to the metal, right? Because it's not that powerful by modern standards. So if you wanted to make it do something interesting, you would have to, you know, optimize it a lot and make sure there wasn't, you know, at a very low level, basically, to directly control it. So it's an interesting thing for people who like, you know, mathematics and physics and generally playing around with computers.
Right. And before you go off to university, what is your community or social aspect for learning or expanding your knowledge about computers and systems? Do you have teachers in high school? Are there message boards or sort of chat rooms? I mean, this is still really sort of pre like America Online and mainstream chat rooms. Are you connecting with people around these ideas before university?
Just a few, like when I was younger, just a few classmates who had, you know, similar, you know, had a computer at home and were interested in it. But at college, which is, well, age 16 to 18 in the UK, they had a computer lab. So I taught myself Pascal on those, but there was no taught subject. So you couldn't do A-level computer science, for example, otherwise I would have done that. So I just, you know, you were able to go and use them. So I set about teaching myself Pascal and using it to try and make some kind of rendering for 3D shapes and representing 3D shapes and rotating them and rendering. So just kind of mathematical programming, I guess.
Did you start studying distributed systems before cryptography?
Or was that So I started on distributed systems first. So I got to degree. I then was able to do computer science as a subject, so that was supported at the time. I mean, of course, at this time, some years later, you can do computer science, you know, even in school, right? Like below 16, but at that time it was at least where I was only offered at degree level. And even that wasn't offered in most universities. So I did the computer science degree at Exeter University, and it was like an undergrad degree. You know, you're taught different programming languages and theory and data structures and complexity and stuff like that. And then when I finished that, I decided I would like to do a PhD. So I picked distributed systems for that. And so, you know, spent a lot of time. I mean, it's less directed, right? So you're more, you know, trying experimental things, trying out different languages. And the computer lab had some distributed sort of parallel computers with high-speed interconnects called transputers. They had a couple of generations of those. So, you know, there are lots of different interesting things you could do with that and work with your thesis advisor to pick out, you know, something to do. So to, you know, first of all, catch up with what other people were doing in a similar area and see if you could improve something. And during that, one of my friends who's doing a master's degree was using those same transputers, like the parallel systems, to try and speed up RSA encryption. So I was just chatting to him. So I heard from him an explanation of what RSA encryption was. And of course, you know, computers were slower then, so it was interesting to try and speed it up with lots of, you know, network connected cores. And not so long after that, then PGP was released. And so that was in like the tech news. And so I found that, you know, and I had a connection because I knew at that point what RSA was, and that's, you know, one of the main pieces of technology in PGP. So I found, you know, the societal reaction to PGP pretty interesting. You know, the establishment didn't necessarily like it because it changed the balance of power towards individuals. And so I got interested to, you know, find out other things like that, you know, and look around online for where people were exploring new ideas in that space. That's where I found the Cypherpunks list. And so, you know, then I actually spent quite a bit of my time learning about applied cryptography, self-taught, and sort of used up a bit of time in the middle of my PhD and then finished the distributed systems part at the end.
Would you at this, when you got into the Cypherpunks mailing list, would you consider yourself at that time a cypherpunk, or was that something more that other people would have referred to people interacting in that community? Was it sort of an ethos?
It's a kind of interesting mix of computer science and the mathematics of applied cryptography, and using that to try and improve, self-determination, the ability for users to sort of take matters into their own hand and assert privacy. So, they had a theory for it. And of course, there are different commentators that have written about this over the years before then, that, in the online world, you were losing a lot of privacy because, ISPs were logging IP addresses and everything was clear text. So, there's some sort of default privacy in the physical world because you're in proximity and nobody's eavesdropping and things like that. Whereas online, it's all, very global and readable with discussion forums and emails weren't encrypted and so on. So this was even, originally there was no SSL to credit cards on websites. So that came a bit later. So people's, the cypherpunks thought process as well, if you want to do something about this, you just have to build the software, and if people use it, that will solve the problem. So there was very little concern given to seeking permission to do that, but just more about, building things that could improve privacy for the individual. I mean, the sort of killer app for this kind of privacy tech was, if you can use the internet privately, you can browse, you can send emails and communicate, you really needed a private way to pay. So electronic cash was the holy grail kind of internet privacy tech, but it was much more challenging to build than the other things which there are implementations of.
When you came across cryptography and even more so the cypherpunk movement, did you think that this was a winnable fight in a David and Goliath kind of sense, that an individual could create free and open source software that could really protect the individual and or defeat the state in some way? I mean, it seems like a very brave thing to do or sort of risky to take on this endeavor.
It wasn't without political risk, I guess. So some of the, people can use privacy for communication, but they can also use it to send, threatening messages that somebody will complain about, right? And so, of course, when that happens, sometimes the recipient will complain to the authorities, and the authorities will try to, whether that's the local police or something, will try to figure out, who the original sender was, and they'll arrive at, the operator of a piece of privacy tech, like a remailer or something, and so they'll try to pressure them to provide the information. Of course, they don't know it because there's no logging and it's all encrypted and it's multiple hop like Tor, these remailers, so they really didn't have the information. But nevertheless, some of them would get into, into legal problems with that. And I think the EFF actually helped defend people in that situation. So I ran one myself for a while, but I was running it in a different country, in a sort of rented shell account from a small one-man ISP. And so I just figured I would run it until there any problems arose, and then I'd shut it down and let somebody else do it, and that way I'd provide useful functionality, but avoid, making a test case of myself. Right. I mean, the aim was to succeed, which is to provide privacy, not to, engage in, prolonged legal arguments, which, wouldn't have had funding for, and is obviously problematic for the people that got stuck in that situation. So it seemed to work out in the end, because, eventually they did indeed contact the ISP, and he said, well, I'm a small ISP and that's one of the users. So he told me and I shut it down, and that was the end of it. I mean, there was no further contact. but it lasted, you know, for some years, and there are many of them.
Yeah. In terms of privacy, though, at what point, and cryptography, do you think early on in maybe university or right after university, you thought of this as maybe your life's work or something that you would just always work on during your life, these issues and these problems?
Well, I found it very interesting and, you know, had a drive to do it. So, you know, at that time, I found it the most interesting thing to do. So you kind of get the bug for something and you're going to, you know, devote a lot of free time to it and try to, you know, if you're inventive in mathematics and programming and system thinking, maybe you can, you know, find a new technology that can help. So that was my kind of skill set. So I, you know, tried to build and design different systems. So I did one which was an attempt to implement a simplified version of Eternity, which was a kind of distributed file store or web, like a distributed web. Basically, you could, you know, put files in it, and the point was that they'd be hard to censor, like to take down because it's distributed, and that they should stay there for a long period of time. So, you know, they shouldn't, if somebody forgot to pay a hosting fee, it shouldn't go away. And there shouldn't be a hosting company that somebody can call to take it down. And so there was an academic paper called The Eternity Server, I think, by Russ Anderson. And, you know, it was a little elaborate, but I simplified it and used the Usenet discussion broadcast mechanism to broadcast basically encrypted pages of web content. And then there were thousands of Usenet hosts online. And if you use this piece of software and pointed at a Usenet feed, it could render these web pages. And, you know, they could be encrypted, they could be signed, you could make updates to them. But unless you had the key, you couldn't modify them and you couldn't delete them. And it'd be pretty hard to censor, like to prevent publication, and pretty hard to take down once it was there. And if people had a password, you know, in a group and they were sharing a web page, then somebody who didn't have that password wouldn't be able to see it. So it was using PGP. And there were other sort of high level protocols built on top of Usenet. You know, there were people that were ripping movies and posting them in parts on there, and there were tools to, you know, reassemble the fragments basically. So it was a pattern that Usenet was a kind of generically reusable slow speed. Like, it's not like for real time. It's more like a email speed, let's say. And it's generally for discussion forums, but, you know, you could put machine generated data or encoded data to a different channel. So you just pick a channel that, or make a new channel and, you know, put your application messages in there that are not really readable without some software, and it will work. So that's what I did. And, you know, so one of the other things I did was try to find, well, worked on electronic cache quite a bit, trying to find, you know, ways to make that work. And one of the things I implemented, which later became used by Bitcoin, was the proof of work stamp. And that was actually related to the Remailer. So people were spamming through the Remailer, because you could use the Remailer for sending an email, but you could also use it to post on these discussion groups that were broadcast globally. And so, you know, in total, used quite a lot of bandwidth. And so it was clear, and the Remailer operators were talking about this, that somebody was spamming through the Remailer, and it wasn't like an advertisement, it was just random numbers. And we thought they were doing it to annoy the system administrators of some of these hosts so that they would, you know, create backlash against Remailers and put some filtering in place to block such messages or something like that. So anyway, it got me thinking about how to control spam because the sender is anonymous by design. Most email spam things are based on, you know, blocking the sender email address or the sender's IP address. And that would definitionally not be possible here. So I was forced to think about it in a different way, which is, and what I observe is that the, you know, the real problem is that email is effectively free or extremely low cost. And so people can generally, you know, spam to enormous extent just as a nuisance, or they can send, you know, millions of unsolicited bulk emails a day with a very low click-through rate and still make money. And so I was like, well, maybe I can create a cost. You know, obviously, you know, credit card is difficult to accept. There was no PayPal at the time, and not everybody has a credit card. And it's got a minimum fee. It's got all kinds of scalability problems. And there was no, you know, deployed large-scale e-cash system like Bitcoin, even though people were, you know, building things that were somewhat centralized. Like there was a DigiCash e-cash system. And I guess the DigiCash system came afterwards, actually, did it? In any case, the DigiCash original paper was, you know, long before Hashcash. That was in 1985, and Hashcash was 97. But I figured that you could use a little bit of work to prove to the recipient that the sender had spent some effort. And that was using hash collisions. And so it's just the observation that the hash functions behave a bit like random number generators. And so it's sort of like throwing lots of coins and, you know, tossing coins and hoping that a certain number of them come up heads and then you would succeed. And so the only way to really do that work is just keep trying. So brute force. So it's kind of measuring, you know, that's what creates the cost. It's very easy to verify, you know, just run the hash function once and you see how many leading zeros. But to do the work, you know, if there are 20 leading zeros, it would take a million tries, which, you know, might take a few seconds on the computer of the day.
Right.
So, and then I made a kind of difficulty for it, which is you would state in the stamp how much work it was intended to have. And then the recipient would be able to verify that it had that much. And maybe the recipient could also generally increase over time how much work they would demand based on the speed of computers. So it would keep up with computing power improvements. And people, you know, ended up using that. I mean, it got integrated into remailers so that you could have to include a stamp to send an email or a Usenet message outside of the system. We got used later for a number of other systems, like for a more expensive stamp for creating a pseudonym to prevent click fraud on websites where people will be incentivized to, you know, create advertisement clicks and get paid advertisement revenue. But there's a general problem with people sort of making robots that do that to emulate humans. So somebody built a hash cash related system to, you know, make it more expensive. It also started a conversation really about whether hash cash was a bit like digital gold and whether an electronic cash system could be based on it. So, you know, the context was, you know, not so many years before there had been the DigiCash electronic cash system, and it was centralized, highly private, but centralized. And the company that operated it went out of business eventually. And so, you know, then it stopped functioning. You couldn't actually tell whether a coin you had was spent or not because the database was on the server.
Right.
So, you know, of course, people were very excited about the potential for this DigiCash system. I mean, you know, the vibe was somewhat Bitcoin-like, but on a smaller scale. When that, you know, system was running, they were trying to get it into commercial adoption. It was a bit like stablecoins in today's terminology because they were, you know, aiming to get a relationship with the bank so that you could put, you know, fiat money into it and get a token. You could respend the token. Eventually, somebody could take it out and get the bank balance back. So there was no kind of, you know, electronic scarcity, digital scarcity component to it. It was just a representation, a sort of bearer tokenized representation of fiat money in a bank account, ultimately. But, you know, people had seen that system fail. And one of the lessons that you could take from that was, well, why did it fail? Well, one reason is it's centralized. And the other reason is it needs a relationship with a bank. And those are both make it difficult for it to be robust and, you know, self-sufficient, survivable, like, that it would keep running. And so it seemed like multiple people saw Hashcash as a potential building block to help, you know, to go into the mix of bricks you could put together to try and construct electronic cash system. And so, you know, the idea basically being that you could mine to create a coin, and, you know, then you would have a coin with an actual scarcity and a cost that didn't require a banking interface. But then, of course, you needed to prevent it being double spent. So, you know, then people were talking about a decentralized double spent database. So, you know, Nick Szabo wrote about that. I think Wade Dye did as well with B-Money. And, you know, then if you've got a decentralized database, then you need to coordinate and deal with race conditions, which is where the Byzantine generals problem comes in. It's a well-known computer science problem definition with some reasonable solutions. But none of those systems got implemented because, I mean, to my mind, there seems to be some gaps in their functionality. So they were maybe not quite buildable, or they relied a bit too much on human judgment or something like that, right? So in B-Money, there's a kind of sort of set of servers involved, like supernodes in the peer-to-peer network, and they would, you know, vote amongst themselves, I guess humans, once a month to decide how much work it should take to create coins this month or something like that, right? So it doesn't feel very, you know, that feels like that's subject to human judgment, and those guys would then be, you know, kind of like a monetary policy committee or something, and might end up in a conflict of interest situation. And Nick Szabo had a different variant, which is a bit more sophisticated, which he just said, well, you know, people can make as many coins as they want, or stamps, I think he was calling them. And then you have a specialized market called a collectibles market, where experts would assemble stamps of different scarcity into a book, which had a kind of standardized unit of scarcity. So it could have, you know, lots of not very scarce ones and a few fairly scarce ones. And you could assemble a standardized scarcity level, and that would be a coin. And that way, you know, there wouldn't be a need to to set a cost on creating coins directly, and you'd have a sort of standardized scarcity. But of course, the scarcity itself will be evolving over time as computers get faster. So I'm not sure that he factored that in. So anyway, neither of these things seemed quite implementable, and so it didn't get implemented. But, you know, people spent a lot of time over some years brainstorming about how to make it work, you know. And one of the discussions was sort of, even very early discussions before B-Money and Bitgold was, you know, well, if you use this as an electronic cash mining protocol to create coins, won't you end up with hyperinflation, because computers get faster and people can make money doing it, they'll just do more and more of it, and you'll have, you know, hyperinflation, and then they won't be able to hold onto a value. And so, you know, people were trying to figure out how to control the difficulty, and you can see from the B-Money approach that it was difficult. It wasn't obvious people how to do that in a decentralized way without human involvement. I suspect part of the problem was some of the people working at this, like myself particularly, were, our problem statement was, well, it should be stable priced, you know, it should be, you know, it shouldn't require a banking relationship, but, you know, there should be a very amount of work selected to make a coin that costs a dollar to produce or something. And it seems very hard for a computer network to do that, because it doesn't know what a dollar is, it doesn't know how fast the computers are, and it can't measure it and stuff like that. So so that didn't go anywhere. And so another thing that got built, I mean, that got designed and actually built in a prototype form was RPAL by Hal Finney, which is reusable proof of work. And with that one, you send it a hashcash token, and it sends you back a digicash electronic cash coin that's respendable. So it does use a centralized server. Now, one of the problems I didn't mention with the digicash server approach is there's no audit. So you are trusting the server not to issue more coins than it has fiat in a bank account, or than people have sent it work for, right? So it's in a privileged position. So Hal Finney found a solution to that, which is he used a new piece of technology called trustworthy computing, where you'd have a sort of tamper resistant CPU or PCI card, and it could give you a hardware signature to convince anybody remotely as to what software it was running. And then because you would know what software it's running, you'd know that it would locally prevent double spending, basically.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a bit of an old concept, but computers, you know, have these things on in the cores these days. You know, they're not perfect, but they're a security model. And that was a hope at the time that that could become, you know, a widely used and dependable building block for security programming. So he built it as a prototype and left it running for a while. So I think that was, you know, I guess there were some less well-known ideas, but that was the in 3 plus Hashcash before that and DigiCash before that. And then there was a, you know, that so RPAL was in 2004. And then it wasn't until, you know, 2008 that Satoshi started posting, you know, drafts, emailing people and posting drafts of the Bitcoin white paper and subsequently the Bitcoin source code in January 2009, where he'd evidently, you know, solved that last problem by actually not concerning himself with, you know, by changing the problem definition almost, it seemed like, and just fixing the rate of supply of coins and let the market decides how it values them. And that turns out to be something that a computer network can verify and enforce across, you know, thousands of nodes. So, then Bitcoin started its long bootstrap process, right? So yeah. I guess, you know, I wasn't involved in Bitcoin actively till 2013, though I'd heard about it, you know, via Satoshi and some early mailing list discussions in 2008, 2009. So, but, you know, once Bitcoin was released, it seemed like it took a few years until there were exchanges where you could exchange it for dollars. And before that, it seemed, you know, at least from talking to people who were involved, like Dustin Trammell and others, that it was a bit more hobbyist, right? You know, people would just send money for fun or in exchange for, you know, a t-shirt or a pizza at an arbitrary exchange rate. And just kind of more of a hobbyist activity.
Prior to Bitcoin, I mean, that was an amazing way to describe a lot of the incremental addition of ideas through time there, especially in the 90s and early 2000s. Were you following along on a lot of these developments in real time? I don't mean like within hours, but, you know, were you excited when Al Finney released, you know, RPOW, when Nick Szabo wrote a paper? Were these kind of like exciting developments that you would follow in real time? And did you ever go to meetups in person?
Well, I was certainly tracking, you know, and actively interested to read any new applied crypto papers or academic papers that might have applied use to try and solve the problem. And I think there are, you know, a number of people with that mindset that it was really interesting and important to solve, you know, to find a way to build a deployable electronic cash system. And so, yeah, I was, you know, certainly interested in what Wei Dai next level had proposed. And actually, I think when she sent me the draft white paper in 2008, I had sort of, you know, read parts of it and then sent him the paper, Wei Dai's B-Money paper, because it seemed, you know, related. Before I really digested it, it seemed like, oh, this is actually pretty similar, but actually, you know, fills in the pieces that didn't work back then. And so I sent that to him, and he actually contacted Wei Dai, because Wei Dai published the emails, and I ended up citing B-Money in the paper as well. So yeah, I was, you know, for many years, you know, like working on and off on electronic cash protocols and trying to figure out ways to make it work.
I'm kind of curious, what was your sort of Bitcoin aha moment? And I'm assuming you saw that he was using Hashcash and proof of work in the white paper, or did that you learn that later on?
No, he said that in the email, so I caught that right away. And yeah, I mean, I thought it was immediately interesting for having solved, you know, found a creative way to solve the problems that were kind of preventing the implementability of the earlier attempts that people had made. And, you know, a little bit curious that he didn't seem to be aware of, you know, B-money and things like that. So quite possible that he'd, you know, redeveloped or reinvented some of the concepts there. And there had been an attempt to bootstrap you in DigiCash's eCash server. So they set up a demo server and they said that they would, you know, they'd run it for a long period of time and there would be a limited number of coins, like 1 million. And they, as I recall, you could get some coins by emailing them and they'd send you a few. And then you could, you know, you could transact with them. You could send them to each other. And so some of the people on the CypherPunks list thought it'd be an interesting practical experiment to see if, you know, a few hundred of them could bootstrap a value by basically, you know, selling t-shirts and electric books and, you know, just kind of doing kind of early experimental things and maybe get a value to stick by doing that on something that had no production costs, but at least had, you know, centralized assurance of scarcity. So, I mean, you could see that in a similar concept to, I don't know, like playing cards, which are not many manufactured, or rare stamps where, you know, there's only a certain number of them or something. So they can end up being a scarce collectible. So I think, you know, there's that kind of concept there. So, you know, and that, so there was some precedent there. And so, you know, seeing Bitcoin software released, people starting to try it out, you know, the obvious question is, would it, and so there was something that went wrong with that bootstrap experiment, which is DigiCash went bankrupt, like not long into the experiment. So it was kind of cut short, but it might have worked, you know, so there was a kind of hope that maybe that would have worked. And you know, people were interested in it. Of course, it might have, you know, they might have, you know, grown disinterested after a while. But, you know, alternatively, it might have taken off, right? So so there were these kind of open questions swirling about, you know, what's going to happen with Bitcoin? Is it going to bootstrap? You know, the scarcity is much better defined, you know, because the scarcity in DigiCash, you have to trust them because it's an unalterable, whereas Bitcoin is alterable. And there's a cost. So you don't have to, you know, ask somebody to give you some of these scarce coins and then trade them, swap them for things. So I thought, well, that's an interesting experiment. Let's see if it bootstraps. And, you know, it seemed like it took a few years before, you know, much indication of that happened, you know, so it really stayed in that kind of, you know, sending things for arbitrary exchange rates period for some years. And, you know, I was doing other stuff, working in startups and things. And so, but just keeping an eye on the news, and occasionally you'd see something about Bitcoin pop up and say, I saw something, I think on Slashdot that Bitcoin reached $1. And I don't know what, yeah, that's probably like 2012 or something. And then, you know, a while later, I saw $100. And of course, you know, Bitcoin has more coins, it's like 21 million, whereas the DigiCash demo was 1 million, so less coins. So when it got to $100, I was thinking, well, you know, I guess something's happening there, right? That sounds like it's volatile, but it's holding a value. There's got to be a reasonable number of users for that to be the case. And I guess by then there were like one or two exchanges as well. So I thought, well, maybe it's bootstrapped. And so I decided, you know, spent more time trying to catch up with the details of how it worked.
Right. Part of that, I know you spent quite a bit of time trying to tear it apart and improve it. I'm kind of curious when... or what was your reaction to the way the code was written? How good of a coder do you think Satoshi was? And I preface that with, you know, coding is only one aspect, I think, of the project, but kind of a really important one.
Yeah, I mean, So there wasn't that much documentation at the time. Mm. And so in trying to work out, understand and catch up with how it worked, I read what I could find online. And one of the things I found was a walkthrough of the code. So somebody had gone through the code and explained, you know, all the modules and processes and structures and main operations and functions. I mean, the code didn't seem too bad to me. It seemed like, you know, fairly systematic and relatively low bug rate, evidently, from the reliability of the network. I mean, maybe coding is has an aesthetic to it, right? You know, different people use different comment styles and get very religious about their comment style is best or something like that, or indentation.
I heard yours could be very brief and elegant.
Well, yeah, I tend to use like short variable names and not use the, they call that like Polish notation or something, where you put the, you know, the type of the variable at the beginning of it as a letter encoding. So I think Satoshi did more of that, which I don't really like. So anyway, everybody's got their style. But if you start contributing to a project, the normal thing to do is to fit in with the style of the project so that your code, you know, is readable to everybody else in the project. But as far as I think most people could see, the Bitcoin initial source code was all written by one person, most likely, just because it's all the same style. So, yeah, I mean, then I guess the other thing I did was, you know, I ran out of things to read and I had lots of questions left. So I figured, well, you know, the way to find out more will be to find out, you know, clearly there are some people developing and maintaining it, to find out where they are, hanging out online and talking amongst themselves about design questions and things. So I went looking around and found Bitcoin Wizards IRC channel. And so, you know, I asked them many questions that, you know, would seem like stupid questions originally at the start. And like, you know, I learn more of the system and ask more intelligent questions and then gradually catch up and then start trying to suggest, you know, identify problems, ask if it had solution, if there was a solution, or suggest solutions. And one of the problems I noticed was the, I don't know if I was the person that noticed it, but there was an already identified problem of a sort of malleability. So I proposed this sort of general pattern of a solution, which is sort of similar to what SegWit does, but not exactly. So, you know, there were lots of known limitations, and many of those have been improved or fixed over time. And one of the things I proposed at that time was that it would be, you know, that the Schnorr signature was a better signature and Bitcoin could benefit from using it. So I spent some time explaining the advantages of that and discussing it with people. And, you know, many years later that actually, you know, got implemented and actually into Bitcoin more recently.
Yeah.
But it's a long, there's a long like time frame there.
Wow.
As well, you know?
Yeah, that is a long time frame. And I think there's some other things that you've kind of, new technologies, I think that could be applied to Bitcoin. And I hope to touch on that a little bit. I'm kind of curious what you thought of Satoshi's disappearance, not from a leadership point of view or an economic point of view, but from a computer science, a privacy point of view, from having the foresight to be able to disappear after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from somebody who ran a remailer and worked on applied cryptography and security software, you do adopt a kind of you know, a security mindset where you think about risks and what operational security practices you'd have to put in place to control those risks. And so, you know, if you see somebody act in a way over a period of time where they succeed at that, like, you know, you would appreciate that took some planning, that took some forethought, basically, right? If you know, if Satoshi was to start Bitcoin and, you know, talk to people and decide afterwards to be private, it'd be too late because there'll be, you know, IP addresses and breadcrumbs all over the place. So evidently he must have thought about that beforehand and planned that. But, you know, at the same time, I think, you know, particularly on the cypherpunks, there were quite on the mailing list, there were a decent number of people who were posting anonymously or pseudonymously. I think I went back and looked, maybe about 5% of posts were anonymous.
Well, I mean, and, what are we talking about? Is that like 10 people or is that like 20, you know, or 100? I mean, it's not a very big group.
Yeah, I mean, part of the beauty is you wouldn't know how many exactly, and you wouldn't know if it's the same person, right? Unless they were, you know, elaborating on something that they just commented on. I mean, some of them would use a pseudonym, but some would just be like no name, just like, you know, a comment standing on its own. But yeah, there are a few thousand people on the list. So, you know,
that's a lot.
10 to 100 is plausible.
Yep.
And so, you know, and there were some anonymously published software systems posted on the Cypherpunks list over time. So there was a system called Magic Money. It's another eCash system, actually. So it was basically an implementation of a Chrome server where you could run your own Chrome server. And, you know, it could create coins and you could give them to people and they could respend them. But it's sort of a little bit novel in the sense that everybody was their own coin issuer. So it's like, you know, everybody has their own coins. So it didn't seem like overly practical because there would be no, you know, kind of exchange rate. But it was a piece of technology, you know, so it implemented some things and, you know, I guess helped people gain understanding. And that was published anonymously by a pseudonym called Product Cipher, spelt with a zero instead of an O and maybe a one. So, and there was another one to do with steganography called PGP Stealth, which was a way to kind of take a PGP encrypted message and transform it so that it would not be recognizable as a PGP message. So it would look like random numbers, unbiased random numbers. And then those unbiased random numbers could be encoded into something like a picture or something and then decoded afterwards with a key. So it's a way to sort of hide the presence of cryptography, which is what steganography means. And that's published by Henry Hester. There are probably a couple of others. So there's a little bit of a trend to publish anonymously or pseudonymously, which is probably lacking in other areas of the internet. So it's kind of interesting that Satoshi chose to do that. Now, I mean, you might wonder, you know, why? Well, I mean, I guess you could infer that, you know, if something became widely used but unpopular to the establishment, then having an identified author or original author could expose that person to, you know, political risk or what have you. Now, that wasn't always the case because, you know, PGP was written by identified people, though I would say that, you know, Phil Zimmern, who's the original creator of PGP, you know, had some significant legal challenges for doing that to do with, you know, ostensibly to do with export regulations, but, you know, and they were basically in place probably to deter private citizens from encrypting messages such that, you know, governments couldn't decrypt them, basically, right? So I guess that, you know, the fact that he got in so much, you know, legal problems, eventually that got thrown out, but it was quite some years of, you know, legal headaches for him. So the fact that that happened and that people saw that happening, if they were paying attention, would probably help them, you know, think about, well, maybe there's a way to prevent this, which is to be anonymous. And then, you know, they can't, you know.
Do you think it's possible that some state entity knows the identity of Satoshi and we don't know that the state knows? I'm asking from a computer science privacy perspective. Is it possible that Satoshi left breadcrumbs that could reveal his or her identity?
Possible, I suppose. Well, you know, if they would be monitoring or logging more internet transit data, which perhaps individual researchers wouldn't have access to. But you know, he probably used, you know, some privacy tech like Tor and PGP and stuff like that, you'd guess. I mean, he seemed to be knowledgeable and careful from people not being able to find any breadcrumbs. And so those were the known tools to use and remain to be the case today. And at least Edward Snowden, you know, the whistleblower, has, I think, said that, you know, in his opinion, which might be somewhat informed by having worked at a US agency, right? That it's that Tor is secure and stuff like that. So he was asserting that, you know, the agencies don't have the decryption or traffic monitoring correlation capability to decrypt some of that stuff. But I mean, of course, you know, the longer somebody were to keep using a pseudonym, the more chance they would get identified, because, you know, if the person is identified once, it's game over, right? So, you know, once they've done their job, it's time for them really to reduce their risk and stop.
Do you think
pick a new name?
Yeah. Has Bitcoin along this, you know, from more like 2013 to now, has it opened up new doors for you? Meaning, because you were looking at a lot of these problems and this narrow design surface for a long time. But in terms of did it provide any revelations or questions? I need to look at this subject matter or that subject matter to better understand Bitcoin. Were there any sort of rabbit holes opened up for you?
You know, when I got actively interested in 2013, I think more active in researching and so on, I spent some time looking at the limitations, and I talked about this online somewhere, but basically tried to figure out, you know, because there are some limitations and you want to know, can you improve them without making other parts of the system worse? And, you know, some of the things it uses are things that I had experience of, like distributed systems and consensus protocols and applied cryptography and peer-to-peer networks. And so, you know, I spent like 3 or 4 months of my spare time, like looking at all the different things that could potentially be improved. And to my surprise, like basically you could change the system so it still work, but you'd usually make one or two things worse for everything you made better. And so it seemed like it's not easily improvable. But the one thing, and of course one problem is it's not very private, like unlinkably private, so that, you know, I mean, the coins are identified and there's no enrollment to, you know, create a wallet or receive a coin, but there is some linkage because of the change of the coins. And so the privacy is not as good as the other electronic cash systems that came before, like DigiCash and so on, right? So I put some thought into whether that could be improved. I'd implemented some of the previous electronic cache systems in a library called Credlib. So I implemented David Chomsky's system. I implemented Stefan Brand's system, which is a discrete log system. And it had some pretty interesting privacy features. So I thought, you know, whether I could use some of those ideas to improve Bitcoin's privacy. And I remembered that there was a footnote in Stefan Brand's PhD thesis book about his electronic cache system, a credential system, which included a range proof so that you could prove a number was within a range. And there'd been another discussion on the CypherPunks list many years ago about encrypted auditable books, so you could have a kind of an accounting ledger and the values in it were encrypted, but you could check they add up even though you couldn't decrypt them, because the encryption would be additively homomorphic, like the encryption of 1 plus the encryption of 2 would equal the encryption of 3, and you could verify that without knowing the values. So that was proposed by Eric Hughes, one of the CypherPunks co-founders, many years ago. And so those two things occurred to me, that, you know, if you do that encrypted thing, it might work for Bitcoin, but then practically if you do it, there's an overflow problem. So you know, I could make, you know, a massive number and the number minus one. And now it still adds up, you know, because it wraps around and sort of create inflation. So you have to prevent that. And so the range proof is a way to prevent it, because you prove that the numbers are small, too small to wrap around. And so in terms of going down rabbit holes, I spent quite a while trying to find space, like a compact, like not too many bytes, range proof to make that practical. And, you know, there's a bunch of literature on cryptographic range proofs, like zero knowledge range proofs, where you don't reveal the value, but you prove it's in a range, in lots of different crypto systems. And eventually decided that the, you know, just optimizing the version cited in this footnote was probably the best approach, because it was reasonably compact and it was using the same cryptography as Bitcoin, like discrete logs and things. So it would fit in. And, so I wrote about it on the Bitcoin Talk forum, and that later became confidential transactions. So it's a partial solution to privacy. It encrypts the amounts, but it doesn't prevent the linkage between you know, a sender and a recipient. Right. It does make the change harder to distinguish, because you can't see, you know, you can't look at the values and figure out what's the change as easily.
Right. I think at this point in sort of Bitcoin's development and your career, what do you see as your life's work at this point? Is it working on Bitcoin? Is it working on privacy? Is it working on cryptography? Is Bitcoin bigger than cryptography? I know it's such a nascent technology.
Yeah, I mean, before I was, you know, when I was getting interested in the cypherpunks topics, I was interested in the privacy technology, disk encryption, uncensorable publishing, you know, all these kind of technologies. But electronic cash was, like, you know, the holy grail, so the kind of most important one and a difficult one to solve. So, you know, I put some effort into solving that, into trying to find a solution to that. And, you know, didn't succeed, but developed Hashcash along the way. And, you know, later some proposed improvements to Bitcoin. But yeah, I think, you know, that Bitcoin has become bigger than the field of applied cryptography, because, you know, the programmers and system designers and crypto analysts working on applied cryptography is not that many people, you know, because most programmers can use libraries and, you know, take some advice from somebody or use an established protocol. So there aren't that many people doing that. And so there's a niche for it. There's a demand for it. It won't go away, because it's hard to secure computer systems. But Bitcoin is just far more exciting and bigger. So, and I think at this point, Bitcoin is a far more societally impactful change, right? So, you know, we have encryption, we have encrypted voice, encrypted text messages, encrypted disks. There's a lot of encryption technology around. So while the usability could be improved, and, you know, some of the forward secrecy could be improved, forward secrecy being that if somebody records your encrypted communication, you shouldn't be able to decrypt it afterwards. Like, somebody could come to you and say, hey, decrypt this, and you can't, because the software has deleted the keys. So some of it could do with improving like that. Some systems do that, some systems don't. But generally speaking, encryption is, like, reasonably well, communication and storage encryption has been reasonably well developed, right? Whereas electronic cash is new and has, you know, a much wider scope, maybe, you know, pretty wide societal impact if it, you know, comes to reach its full potential.
Yeah. How long do you think a young Adam Back or Nick Szabo or Hal Finney or Wideye would be working on Bitcoin? And I mean that in the sense of, like, will Bitcoin oscillate so much in the next 50 years, or is this a 300-year sort of endeavor? In terms of the computer science, the cryptography, the privacy, the working on the protocol, how much ground, yeah. I mean, how much rich ground is there for a young person?
Oh, I mean, it's very rich in
how much fertile ground.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is in like interesting things to learn about or work on, and that interact, you know, game theory and economics and monetary policy and applied crypto and privacy and, you know, proof of work and the dynamic around that. Systems, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to work about on the sort of level computer science part of it. And then, you know, there are applications being built and systems being built on top of it. And there are, you know, quite a few bleeding edge, you know, network systems and computer science problems around it where it hits limits. And there's, you know, it's right at the forefront of what, you know, it's known how to solve with cryptography or software, you know, such as the privacy parts of it. That's quite hard to do better. Scalability, that seems hard to do better. And there are some new things which are newer than Bitcoin, like the SNARKs, so-called signatures of execution, which are zero knowledge proofs that prove a program was run on some data and returned true without revealing what the data was. So it's kind of more elaborate zero knowledge proofs. So bullet proofs are one of those, and there are multiple with SNARKs and STARKs and different versions. But it's a very new area of technology and it's very rapidly innovating. It's an interesting phenomenon, actually, that applied cryptography has become, I think, achieved a boost in interest due to Bitcoin, basically, because if you could achieve a breakthrough in an applied way, it could get used and have a positive use and actually be adopted. Whereas historically, I think a lot of the theoretical crypto would be proving new mathematical things are possible, but then largely not get used, you know? So there's a bit of a difference between applied and theory. A theory is just to prove it's possible. Applied is to do it in such a way that it's dependably secure and efficient and so on. So, but you know, even for the applied uses, it's given a lot of, you know, reason to be working on applied systems and to try and understand the missing features that, you know, Bitcoin would want to use.
Right. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the general shifts over time with Bitcoin and sort of how just the endeavor grows. My final question for you is, if you could orange pill anyone in the world, who would it be?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, young people going through university or starting programming are interesting people to orange pill because they start out as natives, you know. So I think people who have never known there not to be an internet just develop a different sort of native understanding and yeah, may push forward the next innovations.
I think that's a very cypherpunk and decentralized answer, and I appreciate it a lot. I don't think it really comes down to one person, and create, you know, kind of maybe getting the next generation on board and maybe the next inventor or discoverer is more important than someone we might already look up to or already know or might have a lot of sway or persuasion. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, Adam. This has been incredible. This has been really dope. I'll leave it to you. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about and we didn't cover, so I'll leave it to you to let, you know, everyone know where they could find you and things that Blockstream are working on.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Adam3US and Blockstream is blockstream.com. Yeah, so that's it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This very special rip with Dr. Annam Bach was brought to you by CipherSafe. Head over to ciphersafe.io today and make sure to use the code MATRIX to get 10% off and protect your Bitcoins from disaster, a single point of failure, and bad dogs. And thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and keep your head in the game out there. This is said. Peace.